The LinkedIn Podcast Network is sponsored by TIAA. TIAA makes you a retirement promise, a promise of a guaranteed retirement paycheck for life. Learn more at TIAA.org/promisespayoff.
I'm Dan Roth, Editor-in-Chief here at LinkedIn, and welcome to This Is Working, a show where I talk with people who have an outsized impact on our professional world.
I think that as long as people have the knowledge that they have a lot of love around them, it's much easier to go out and pursue other dreams and potentially fail.
That was Jen Hyman, the CEO and co-founder of Rent the Runway. Rent the Runway is a company that could only exist today. It's like a combination of Netflix and Saks Fifth Avenue. The idea is that instead of buying clothes, you can rent the right blouse, dress, jewelry, bag, whatever it is you need for that day or that evening, and have it delivered right to your door so that you can wear it, and then the next day you get something else. Jen is out to change the way that we shop and the way that we dress ourselves. She wants us all to have virtual closets instead of real closets. Now, the average Rent the Runway user uses it about 120 days a year. Jen thinks she can get that up closer to 300 days a year. If you follow the fashion news at all this week, you've probably seen Rent the Runway in the headlines, and not for great reasons. They have had to stop taking on any new customers because they've run into very serious logistics problems. This is causing outrage among their clients and for people who want to be their customers, and Jen is trying to take this on as best as she can. In this interview, which we recorded last year, Jen talks a lot about the importance of logistics and technology in building the company. And what's fascinating is she didn't think that was going to be really central to her company. In fact, she thought she would outsource that part and really just focus on the fashion part. Over time, she realized that was the company. 90% of Rent the Runway's employees are in the technology or logistics group. So getting the logistics right, figuring how to ship the right dress to the right time, to the right woman, is what the company is all about. And if that doesn't work, there is no company. So it's going to be fascinating to see how Jen gets beyond this logistics issue. The other thing that you'll hear in this interview is that Jen is a fighter. She has had doubters the entire time she's been building this company, from when she came up with the idea to trying to get funding to building it out. So dealing with pushback is nothing new for her. But this is a big problem, and how she gets over it is going to say a lot about the future growth of the company. I know I'll be watching closely. I'm sure after listening to this interview, you'll want to watch closely too. Okay, here's Jen Hyman. Jen, thanks for joining us here today. I think a lot of people, when people think about Rent the Runway, who don't know your business, they think about fashion and think about, you know, clothing women, but you were really running a massive logistics company. Would you talk a little bit about what goes on behind the scenes to enable you to get clothes to people around the country?
Yeah.
Well, is it around the world or just around the country?
Right now it's just around the country, but stay tuned.
All right.
You know, if you think about traditional e-commerce, their businesses are based around outbound logistics. How quickly could I get the item to the customer? When it comes to a rental business, your focus has to be on inbound logistics. So how quickly can I get something back from a customer, restore it to perfect condition in order to send it out to the next customer? Now, when you're renting clothes as opposed to renting out, let's say, physical DVDs like Netflix did in the beginning of their business, there's a lot of abnormalities that can happen. Someone can spill a glass of red wine, a hem can rip, something can come back in poor condition. So not only are you taking something, you can't take something through an automated process. You have to triage when you get it back to your warehouse. And therefore, we've had to vertically integrate and run the world's largest dry cleaning operation out of our warehouse. We have to have hundreds of seamstresses to restore things. We have to understand the IP of fabric so that we know what chemicals to use in order to preserve the fabrication over time, because we've learned that most inventory damage actually comes from the chemicals used during the dry cleaning process. It doesn't come from human wear and tear.
So describe what the inside of the dry cleaning or warehouse looks like. What's are there just thousands of people running around looking under microscopes at these clothes? What's happening, you know, day to day?
I often describe it as being like a Willy Wonka land of fashion. There's clothing that's just going robotically on trolleys everywhere. And it, for people who love clothes, you go into the warehouse and you're like, this feeling of reckless abandon, like, I'll take that, I love this. What's actually happening is thousands of people are taking it through a process of receiving the inventory really early in the morning, understanding what we have to do to restore it to perfect condition, and taking it through a quality control process, a dry cleaning process, a repair process, a reassembly process, right? Because if I'm renting out this dress with a pair of jeans and a top, that's a different collection of items that the previous customer had it in. So we have to reassemble and then ship it out that evening. So most of the clothing in our warehouse is actually turned around with a zero-day turnaround time, meaning same day.
And when you started this 10 years ago, did you expect to be this deeply knowledgeable and involved in logistics, in IP of fabric, of cleaning?
I thought we were going to outsource our logistics and outsource our technology. Right now, if you think about our logistics and technology teams, it's 90% of our employees. Hmm. So the very things I thought that we were going to outsource are both the core competencies of the business as well as the barriers to entry. There's really no way to short circuit this. So let's say another company wanted to try to do this again. My first thought is, you know, have fun, be my guest right. in trying to figure out how to, you know, dry clean and restore tens of thousands of units, tens of millions of units of clothing. But you have to actually go through the pain of renting out 1,000 garments to figure out how you can rent out 1 million, to figure out how you can rent out 10 million. You learn so much along the way that's gotten us to the point now where we could have a subscription to fashion that's really catering to women 120 days of the year.
How do you get smart about this stuff? What do you, as a CEO, how deep does your knowledge go about all of the, what's going on in logistics, about the clothing, about the dry cleaning? Do you want to know everything? Are you someone who hires and says, you guys take care of this, I hire the best? Or are you someone who wants to get to know every single detail?
Well, I think as both the CEO and the co-founder of the company, you organically, as a co-founder of anything, are just down in the details. Mm-hmm. I mean, at the very beginning of the company, we were the ones packing out the orders every single day. We were the ones, you know, putting something through a dry cleaning process. I was at every single designer appointment. I had to deal with the pain of if I bought clothing from a designer and that clothing fell apart after we turned it two or three times, that was just money that we had lost. So whether I liked it or not, I had to get onto the ground floor of every aspect of the business. Now that it's 10 years later and we have an incredible team, I'm far less in the weeds than I was before, but I think a great leader knows when to flex the altitude. So they know when to stay up at 100,000 feet and focus on the vision and the strategy, and for which two to three really, really important things every year that you go down to that 1 foot level.
Would you just walk me through how you do that? Do you have weekly meetings with your team? Do you have skip level meetings where you're dropping in and people are getting smart on what it is they're doing? How do you make sure that you are both flying very high and going down to the ground level?
Well, I think that there are some rituals that you set up within a company. So we do have weekly exec team meetings. We'll have a monthly all hands meetings. I'll certainly have skip level meetings with folks who are experts in their domain, because at this point, you know, the experts are people who are directors or VPs within the company. But I also think that when you think about a company, I often think about it as a chapter in a book. And so you would say to your whole organization, this year is the year that we are scaling subscription. And therefore, the most important priorities are going to be these three priorities. And those are therefore the priorities that I'm giving myself permission as the CEO to go more into the details, because I've just said out loud that these are the things that are most important.
And that's once a year you said that?
Yes. In fact, we just had a vision presentation that I gave to the company last week where I was talking about what next year is going to be about.
I know that one of the things you're pushing into is making sure that it is easier for women to get their clothes and to return their clothes. What are you doing to increase your distribution?
We are in the midst of launching a national partnership with WeWork, where we in WeWork lobbies across the country are going to have Rent the Runway drop boxes where our subscribers can take back the clothing they've already worn, drop it up in the drop box, and then immediately on their app choose the next items they want and receive them either same day or the next day. So it really expedites how quickly you're going to be able to turn around the clothing you have. And therefore, the average subscriber can go from using us 120 days of the year to potentially 150 or 175. Because how we think about this business over time is that the only metric that really matters is usage. If you're going to change consumer behavior, you're more likely to do that if she's using you more of the days of the year.
So how many days of a year on average, does a subscriber use the service now?
So right now, she's using us 120, which is remarkable.
That's pretty high, yeah.
Because if you think about other things that we do all the time, you know, for instance, the average American buys a cup of coffee 85 days of the year. So the fact that 2.5 years after we launched this subscription, that our customers are already using us 120 days of the year is a signifier to all of us that they were really ready to put their closets in the closet.
What does that mean? A third of the year, one of your subscribers is...
wakes up, she decides, I'm not going to go into my own personal closet today. I'm going to wear an outfit that's rented.
And by opening up more distribution, what do you expect that to get to?
I would like it to get to, over time, 250, 300 days of the year.
Your goal is your closet is basically empty except Rent the Runway rentals that you have filling it up for and is changing all the time.
I think that your closet should be filled with some investment pieces that you can wear over and over again that provide almost the canvas to what your Rent the Runway subscription is doing. So you should own a black cashmere sweater and you can wear it with a new skirt from Rent the Runway every single day or a new pair of pants. But people should be thinking about their clothing purchases as investment pieces and in terms of cost per wear. The industry over the last 30 years has moved away from that. And in fact, close to 85% of the purchases in this $2.4 trillion industry are kind of one-time use or two-time use purchases. So we go into a store with the intention of, I'm going to buy this quick fix. It's something that I want right now. It's an impulse purchase. It fulfills a trend. I'm going to wear it once or twice, and then I'm either going to throw it away or I'm going to push it to the back of my closet. So effectively, we've been renting the runway as consumers for decades. We've had that high, the sugar high of wearing something once that you fall in love with, and then that crash that comes when you realize you're never going to wear it again.
And I assume the same day delivery push is a way to still enable that kind of sugar high without actually having to crash.
Exactly. So Rent the Runway, we think, is a more sustainable way to get that emotional high of self-expression. You know, a lot of people attack fast fashion, including me, for being not sustainable. But fast fashion really answers the customer need. The customer wants variety. The customer wants the ability to express herself via what she wears or what he wears every day. And now rental is just going to be a much better substitution and a much more high quality substitution for that.
The LinkedIn Podcast Network is sponsored by TIAA. In the last 100 years, we've seen financial markets swing, new currencies come and go, decades of savings lost in days, all showing that a retirement plan without a guarantee, quite simply, isn't enough. So more than a retirement plan, TIAA makes you a retirement promise, a promise of a guaranteed retirement paycheck for life, a promise that pays off. Learn more at TIAA.org/promisespayoff.
You talked about self-expression. One of the things that you have really become known for is having your own really strong voice. Beyond just being the voice of the company, you've taken up many industry causes. You talk a lot about gender equity in venture capital. You talk a lot about pay equity within companies. How do you balance being the voice of Rent the Runway and the voice of workers everywhere and of female entrepreneurs and thinking about yourself not just as being trying to help your business, but trying to help a whole lot of people? How do you balance the two?
Well, I think over the last few years in particular, as I've had less confidence in being able to rely on government and Washington to make the right moral decision on behalf of the American public. At the same time, Rent the Runway has scaled dramatically over the last few years. So suddenly you get out of your bubble and you realize, wait, there's 1,500 people and their families that work for me today. That number is likely going to be double next year, and Lord knows what it'll be a few years from now. I have a responsibility that's just beyond making money for shareholders. I have a responsibility to make the lives of the people that work for me as happy and as equitable and rich as I possibly can. And one of the things that's really guided me is an appreciation for where I am right now. And I know that where Rent the Runway is because of our entire team. It's not because of me. It's not because of my co-founder. It's not because of our senior level executives. This is a business that is very complicated to execute. And in fact, some of the hardest work is the work that's happening with our hourly workers in our warehouse every single day. And many of those hourly workers have been at Rent the Runway for 7, 8, even 9 years, dedicating themselves to the growth of our company. So I started to think about the inequity that exists in business that I had been part of perpetuating for the first, you know, chapter of Rent the Runway. And that inequity was treating and compensating our hourly and our salaried employees differently, meaning that we had a different set of benefits that we gave to our salary employees that were more generous. We gave people more flexibility, more parental leave time, more time for bereavement leave if someone in their family passed away, more sabbatical policies to celebrate their loyalty to the company. And we were really doing bare bones things for the workers in my warehouse and customer service team and retail stores. I began to question why that was. And the only reason I had is that we had copied what other best-in-class companies did and that I'd never spent the time thinking about the implications of my own actions.
Well, I thought that you wrote about that and said, as a startup founder, you spend a lot of your time looking at these large companies and learning about corporate culture based on what they've done. Do you think that there is a change that will come from other founders who will start thinking, let's not copy what's been done in the past, let's have our own rule book? Or is it just easier and your investors aren't asking for this to just do what you need to do to keep growing the business? You don't think about these larger this larger social impact you can have?
I think that the founders of today are trying to create a workplace of the future. And we already see that employees are making their decisions on where to work, not only based on where their salary is going to be the highest. They want to work for companies that represent their values and companies that are authentic to their mission. So employees are the first to leave a company if that company is not really walking the walk when it comes to their values. So one way I thought about our benefits change was to equalize benefits across our hourly and salaried employees, was certainly about doing the moral thing. The second way I thought about it is we're a company that is meant to stand for equal opportunity for all genders, for all ethnicities, et cetera. Well, we need to actually showcase that within the company. And what's interesting is not only was this something that was heralded and so enthusiastically supported at my warehouse, which you would imagine it would be. But in the corporate office, when I announced this, I mean, people were cheering, crying. It was the most positive response that anyone had ever had to any initiative we've ever done. And the benefits of my salaried employees didn't change. But to work in an environment where you know that your colleague, who's day in and day out in our retail store, you know, working their butt off for the common cause, that they're going to be treated with the respect that they deserve to have, I think was really special for all of our team.
And it's still relatively early, but has it changed retention numbers at your company?
We are starting to see that it's changing retention. It's certainly changing the day-to-day culture. within the warehouse. I walk around the warehouse now and I feel that people are able to both be employees and also be human beings. So there were so many hidden costs in not having a policy like this, where people were leaving the company and you never understood why. Now they're being transparent with their managers and they're saying, hey, my mother is sick. I need to take time off to care for her. Or my wife is having a child. I'd like to be home for that event.
Yeah, right. You know, someone was going to quit because her daughter was having a C-section.
And she was the
she
only
was
one
just, her
to
plan
care
was just
for
to, her. Just to quit because she couldn't ask for a leave and that was not going to be an option. That changed her work with you.
It changed her work, but it also changed the mentality of all of the women that she was on our seamstress team, she still is, all of the women that she works with every single day, right, who clearly knew that her daughter was going to have a C-section as well, now know that they can go through and celebrate life events or deal with difficult times, and Rent the Runway is going to support them through those times.
Even beyond this, though, you've been very vocal about this change and talked about what it's meant for the company and why you've done this, but which is great for Rent the Runway. It's your employees like it. Maybe it attracts new talent. But you've gone even beyond just talking about things you're doing and pointing out inequity that you're seeing outside of Rent the Runway. I don't think anyone would fault you for being a founder who is just focused on the company. What makes you want to go and take on larger societal issues, like the question of how much equity female founders get versus male founders, or what's going on in venture capital and how little funding other women entrepreneurs are getting? What makes you decide that you want to spend your time and your voice calling out those things?
I think two reasons. First is there's a recognition I have that the very best founders, the very best ideas come from people who have personally experienced a problem. Right now, we have a set of entrepreneurs who represent the wealthy in this country, who represent people who went to Ivy League schools, who grew up in educated backgrounds, who had every opportunity given to them. I'm one of those people, and I created Rent the Runway. And I'm not claiming that Rent the Runway is addressing the ills of society, because it's not. I was not equipped as a founder to address the ills of society because I haven't experienced them. So unless we diversify the voices and the people that get an opportunity to become entrepreneurs, we're never going to have ideas that really address the full demographics of the country. So the lack of female entrepreneurs is certainly a massive problem only 2% of dollars are going to women. So Clearly it's a problem. But it's also a problem that we're not funding entrepreneurs of different races, of different ethnicities, people who come from the middle of the country, people who come from poorer backgrounds. There's just not a lot of diversity that is in the ranks of entrepreneurships. And it's been the major growth engine of not only the United States, but globally.
Yeah, but couldn't there be some industry org that speaks up on this? Why do you feel like it's important for you to spend your time talking about
that's
this?
That's the second piece of it, which is, if I'm not going to speak up, who will? What's the point of my life if not to have a voice and try to change the world for good? You know, I didn't grow up thinking that I wanted to be an entrepreneur. I came up with the idea for Rent the Runway because I felt like giving women the power to feel confident about themselves every single day, to express themselves how they want, would actually change their lives. And I feel privileged that I've gotten this opportunity. But Rent the Runway is a piece of achieving that empowerment for women for me. And that I feel like I will have failed if I squander this opportunity that I have to make it easier for millions of other women to have the same opportunities to become entrepreneurs and change the world. I mean, it's egregious right now how few women there are in leadership positions, not just across business, in government, in all areas of society. I mean, is it 2018? It's ridiculous. And that's also the case for all underrepresented groups. You know, we just have to speak up so that the world can change.
So does it make you angry or upset when you see other founders who aren't willing to use their platform or their ability to get in the media or use social media to talk about these bigger issues? Or do you think everyone should be doing it? Do you think only certain people should? What do you think your peers should be doing?
I think that more entrepreneurs should certainly be speaking up about missions that are authentically important to them. Mm-hmm. That's not that everyone has to stand for every issue, but there are things that an entrepreneur can uniquely stand for, that their company can uniquely stand for, and their voice is an important part of our national conversation. In terms of focusing on the negative, let's focus on some of the entrepreneurs who have led the way. People like Howard Schultz, who way before it was sexy, was giving, you know, free college education and healthcare to his employees who work in Starbucks stores. That was revolutionary. And I am shocked that more companies haven't followed suit. You know, I think that what's weird is he's proven that you can build a huge, highly profitable company that actually changes the world and do right by your employees. Right. Why wouldn't the leaders of other quick serve restaurants or other food businesses or other people that have stores look to that example and say, wait, this is financially feasible. And in fact, Starbucks employees are more loyal and they have less attrition issues and there are other positive effects. The brand is known for being a brand that has high values.
So why don't they?
I don't know. I think maybe we need a new generation of leadership to enter into these companies and realize that their responsibility lays beyond just the bottom line.
A little bit over a year ago, you went on CNBC and talked about your experience being sexually harassed by one of your investors or a would-be investor. Have you been surprised by any changes or the lack of changes that have happened in the year since you came out with it? Do you feel like you opened a door to something? Was there a better conversation? Or has there been silence? What's it been like in that year?
I think that there is a massively big and positive movement that's happening in the entrepreneurial community. That's represented by organizations like All Raise coming together with this recognition that it is harder for female founders and entrepreneurs. Now, there's a lot of reasons. It's not just related to sexual harassment. Mm-hmm. I think that that's the easiest one to identify. But there's a massive amount of gender discrimination. It's harder for women to hire. It's harder for women to get the amount of capital they need early on. And women are coming together to support each other via All Raise. They're coming together at the wing all over the country to support each other. I think that that can only go so far, though, right? You need men who are the ones who are leading the industry, who are the ones in control, to start making moves within their companies. Now, we have seen a lot of hiring in VCs over the last year where all male firms are starting to hire their first female partner.
Right.
That's great.
Partner.
But we know, and data proves, that having one woman in the room or having one person of color in the room doesn't change the conversation. You need to have a plurality of voices in order for that woman to be able to make a difference. So I think that it's a great first step, but we need to encourage these firms to diversify even further. And it can't really be done soon enough. We're seeing that just yesterday, Kirsten Green at Forerunner announced that she raised a $360 million fund. This is a woman who has had some of the greatest successes in venture capital over the last few years, between her investments in Jet and Warby Parker and Glossier and a whole host of companies, many of which, like Dollar Shave Club, have been acquired or have had great exits. She raised this $360 million fund. I saw an announcement yesterday that an associate from Greylock or Sequoia raised a $500 million fund. The associate had no, didn't have the track record that Kirsten and her partner Yuri has certainly not had the success, has certainly not had the voice. why is it that one of the most successful women in the industry is raising this much? And some effectively, and this guy may be very smart and very talented, but kind of a no-name guy is able to raise a $500 million fund right out of the gate because we're giving him a chance. It's like she has to work so hard to prove that she's worthy of the multi-billion dollar fund. Another guy can just say, hey, I'm here. And suddenly they have a lot more money to play with. And we all know that when you have more money to put to work, there's a higher probability of success.
Right.
Because you have more opportunities to fail.
So you're going to keep going out and saying and pointing out these issues. Part of what you're, as Rent the Runway's platform grows, as your platform grows, I assume it doesn't sound like you're going to be backing off this at all. Right.
I think those little changes to make it more possible for people to see, hey, I can be a great mom, and I can also be a rock star leader at work, and I can do this all, and it's going to be based on my company giving me the flexibility and the trust to pursue all of the things that are important to me. My job being one of them, but my family and my friendships and other hobbies being just as important.
Well, I want to point out one other area where you're bucking the industry, which is 70% of your workers are women and 70% are people of color.
Yes.
When you hear the dialogue that so many executives give about how difficult it is to hire minorities and the pipeline issue and where are they going to go to find these people or retention issues, do you just want to yell and say, I've done this. It's not hard. What's your response to that?
Yeah, I mean,
or is it hard? How do you do it?
It's not hard.
Yeah.
My response is that it's BS that it's hard. Now, it's harder if you have a 1,000-person company and you're all white and you're all men. Like, what woman or what person of color or what LGBT person is going to want to work there? Mm-hmm. Because no one wants to be the only. No one wants to represent the voice of their gender and being the only woman in the room. So you have to start, it's much easier to start diverse if you want to continue to be diverse. But I think that diversity is a value set. You know, this is an industry that claims that it's based on data. We know that the more diverse ideas that you have, who are challenging, iterating, helping you get to the next level, the more successful the company is going to be. So in a data-driven company, why wouldn't you try to stack the deck in your favor from the very beginning and get those diversity of voices from the get-go? So it just bellies everything that we are claiming to be as the tech industry or the industry of venture capital if you have a team that's completely homogeneous.
I'd love to end with some career advice. What do you tell, you must get a million girls and women, young people coming to you saying, how can I be you? I love what you're doing. I like your service. How do I become like you? What kind of advice do you give people?
I think the first thing is to just go for it. I have had a confidence throughout my life, not that Rent the Runway was going to be successful, but a confidence that even if it wasn't, even if the worst possible scenario happened, that worst possible scenario isn't that bad, that you could pick yourself up from it, you can get up the next morning and you could find another job. I think that people often catastrophize a situation and they believe that some call it fear of failure, but it's really feeling like your life ends at that point.
Right.
But the reality is that people have a lot more resilience than they give themselves credit for, and that we have to be aggressive in going after our dreams in our lives. And that's just not your dream for your career. It's your dream for your family life. It's your dream for the type of, you know, social life you want to lead. If you're not aggressive about that dream, it's never going to happen.
Have you always been this confident, or is this something you've learned from experience?
I think that I've always been okay with not having everything work out perfectly or with the idea of failure, because I grew up in a family where I was experiencing a fairly chaotic situation every day, growing up with an autistic sibling and seeing her struggle to just learn how to read, which she still can't do as a woman in her mid-30s right now, or the various things that would happen to us as a family, being excluded from certain environments or having negative things happen to us, and the resilience and positivity with which my parents continue to lead their life and create an example for us that, hey, it doesn't really matter what someone else is going to say about us. It doesn't matter if they want us to leave this hotel. We're going to stay here. We're going to have fun. We're going to laugh. We're going to be a family. And I think that that feeling has permeated my life, that number one, you know, be confident in who you are. And number two, you have a family, you have a support system around you. I think that as long as people have the knowledge that they have a lot of love around them, it's much easier to go out and pursue other dreams and potentially fail in those dreams.
Jen, thank you very much. Really appreciate you spending time with us today.
Thank you so much.
That was Jen Hyman, the CEO and co-founder of Rent the Runway. If you liked what you heard, subscribe on Apple Podcasts. It helps new listeners find the show. Also, share what you liked about the show using the hashtag ThisIsWorking. You can also follow me on LinkedIn and get my newsletter, which is called This Is Working. I'm Dan Roth. Thanks for listening.